Well, thank you, Kerry. The occupational hazard for me, of course, is any forecast I make will be taken as a forecast of next Tuesday's outcome, however far ahead it might be. Well, thanks to the AIG for the invitation to be here today. And the topic that was proposed is the Australian economy to 2020. That would be a 10-year ahead forecast, and that is a risky proposition, particularly for a central banker. What I'd like to do to begin in tackling that is to look back 10 years to a few things that were occurring 10 years ago, and then talk about some trends since then. That, I think, will serve as something of an admonition to be circumspect in making forecasts, but it also allows us the opportunity to identify one or two trends which have been important and which I think are pointers to things which could be important in the future. So let me start that way, and also these things also point us to some important issues in global finance and economics just now, and that's what I'd like to turn to in the second half of the remarks. 2000, 10 years ago, while Sydney had just hosted the Olympic Games, the city of Melbourne had hosted a meeting of the World Economic Forum. The Games, many great sporting moments for us there, but they are perhaps also remembered for their logistical success. The World Economic Forum meeting may be remembered more for the protests than what was said at the forum, as the protests, as you'll recall, turned rather nasty. But those events should also be remembered as having occurred at the height of the dot-com mania and its obsession with the new economy. Australians were told by more than one prominent visitor that year that we lived in an old economy, with the implication that we needed to shift our thinking and our production structure towards the production of IT goods. Blue sky valuations were being applied to companies that had not at that point earned a single dollar. Many of them never would. The Australian dollar was slumping. The Economist in September 2000 printed the following words. As Sydney was presenting the new face of modern Australia to the world, the currency markets were giving a different verdict. At the end of the game's first week, the Australian dollar fell to a record low of 53.63 against its American namesake. They go on to say that this reflects a continuing belief, among other things, that Australia has yet to complete the transition from being an old economy based on natural resources to a new economy fired by information and other technology. And we could give many other examples of that sort of thinking. Well, as we now know, the dot-com bubble had actually begun to deflate when those words were printed. By early 2001, the Federal Reserve would be cutting interest rates, and indeed so would we, as the US economy went into recession. The new economy, so-called, which was the latest but not the last in a long line of new paradigms, still had a business cycle after all. In 2001, the Australian dollar would fall further, reaching about 48 cents. Some people thought that it could fall as low as 30 cents. Now, at that time, some people were making the point that in the old versus new economy stakes, it might actually be the application of new technology rather than the production of it where the gains would be greatest. And on that score, Australia ranked very well. Others made the point that Australia would probably do best in its production structure to stick to its comparative advantages in resources and agriculture and various types of services and indeed certain areas of manufacturing. But it was very hard to make those sensible points against the barrage of market and media commentary. Well, 10 years on, it doesn't seem to have been to our disadvantage not to have built a large IT production sector. On the contrary, our terms of trade are at a 60-year high. The currency almost equals the US dollar in value, and we face an investment build-up in the resource sector that is already larger than what was seen in the 1960s and will get larger yet, very likely. Meanwhile, in the area of IT, the pace of change continues to be rapid, prices continue to fall, profits have proved very hard to come by, and a number of the prominent names in that sector from 2000, of course, have disappeared. It's still better, it seems, to be a user than a producer of IT. Now, the point of saying all this isn't to poke fun at people whose forecasts went wrong. The point is that forecasting is very hard, and that the latest conventional wisdom that we hear and absorb often turns out to be not much more than a passing fashion. We could add, I think, that market pricing, exchange rates, share prices and so on, at some points in time at least, may not be much better than passing fashion, even though I would argue that markets tend, in the long run, to get it roughly right on average. So having given that caution about how hard it is to forecast, let me recount a couple of trends over the past decade. One of those was the increased borrowing by the household sector. That had already been going on for 10 years, nearly 10 years by 2000, and it kept going on for nearly another decade after. I've said before that I don't think this will be a feature of the coming decade. We're seeing more caution in household borrowing, and the rate of saving by households out of current income, although still low, has in fact risen over recent years. It follows from that, it seems to me, that some personal and business strategies which were successful in times when households were gearing up probably will not be as successful in the future. Other trends in the economy over that 10 years have been a continuation of developments that were already underway for a long time. For example, services as a share of the economy has continued to increase. Manufacturing and agriculture have tended to decline a bit, as indeed they have in most developed countries in the world. The mining sector's share of output had for some time changed little since the mid-80s. But that, of course, is now changing and mining share is picking up noticeably, and that probably will continue in the few years ahead. So we're seeing now a faster pace of change in the industry structure of the economy than we have for a while, though on formal metrics that you can compute of the pace of structural change, they've gone up, though they're not as yet outside the range of historical experience. But that might change given the size of the build-up in resources that's underway. Looking at our trade accounts, we can see that the share of resources has gone up over the past decade. Manufacturing, agriculture, services, those shares have tended to decline, not so much because the absolute levels of exports declined. Indeed, services exports have grown considerably, but because the rise in resource exports well and truly outpaced everything else. But it's in the destination of our exports that we see maybe the most striking changes in the past 10 years. Now, as it happens, the Reserve Bank recently, just in the past few weeks, updated the weights in our trade-weighted index of the exchange rate, which are done by exports and imports by country. The weight on the Chinese currency rose 4 percentage points in the last year. That's a big move in 1 year, but it's just the latest manifestation of quite a powerful trend that's been going on for longer. Let me try and see if I can show you that. This is a picture of the weights by country of Australia's merchandise trade by destination 10 years ago and now. Well, a decade ago, Japan was far and away the biggest source or biggest destination for our exports. The US was second, Korea, Europe were third, China was sixth after New Zealand. Well, today, our top export destinations in order are China, Japan, Korea and India, accounting for nearly 60% of exports of goods between them, followed at some distance by the US, New Zealand and Europe, all closely bunched. Now, given the ongoing shift in the world's centre of gravity towards Asia, most countries would be seeing some shift in this direction. And for example, one of the reasons for the strong performance of the German economy this year has been the strength of demand for high-end manufacturers in Asia. But for Australia, this is a particularly powerful phenomenon. It's true that this is just exports and it's just goods because the data for service exports are later in coming out. And when we include imports and services, it's still the case that the US and Europe are important for Australia, though less so these days than China. The US and Europe, along with New Zealand, also account for a large proportion of Australia's investment abroad and the bulk of outward investment into Australia. Moreover, financial developments in the major economies, especially the US, are still very important drivers of capital flows and of shifts in financial confidence and sentiment. So there are still very important links to the major economies. I'm not arguing for decoupling, so-called, if by that idea is meant somehow that the North Atlantic countries no longer matter for the global economy or no longer have an impact on us. Everything is still connected, and economic events in the North Atlantic still matter greatly. But trends in those countries are leavened by developments in an Asia-Pacific region which is both larger and more capable of exerting a degree of independent influence over its own economic performance than it used to be. It used to be said that when the US sneezed, Asia caught a cold. Recently, it seems that the US has contracted pneumonia, while Asia sneezed, caught a bad cold, but then recovered pretty quickly. Even in the financial field, as we're seeing in recent currency discussions, the size of offshore investments by Asian official holders has become quite important, and that's also true for our own currency. And while it's true that the stock of cross-border investment between Asia and Australia remains small compared with that between Australia and the US or Europe, that surely is in the process of changing. Now, the point of saying all this is not to say that somehow Australia has been or will be saved by Asia or China. The emergence of Asia is to our advantage, but we have to respond appropriately, and there's no free ride in the global economy or the regional economy, and there never will be. And nor is it to deny that our own policies, for better or worse, will make a significant difference to economic outcomes. There's no escaping the need to keep your own house in order. The point, rather, is that we ought to take more than a passing interest in events in our region and in the conduct of economic policies in that region, and not just events and policies in the countries that once completely dominated the global economy but no longer do. And that brings me to the issue foreshadowed in the title, Cross Currents in the Global Economy. At the risk of overusing a very cliched term, the global recovery thus far has been very much a two-speed one. The United States, UK, Japan, and some continental European countries saw deep downturns in output, which have left output well below its previous trend, as shown here in the bottom two lines. This is GDP aggregates, it's a logarithmic scale, and the trend from 1996 to 2007 is the straight line. And the point is, relative to that trend, the North Atlantic countries and Japan, especially the North Atlantic, are way below the previous trend at this point. In Asia, outside of Japan, and in Latin America, by contrast, economies have traced out the more traditional V-shaped recovery. The level of real GDP in Asia is well above its previous peak. So it follows that most of these countries are likely to experience a moderation in growth. Indeed, they're likely to need a moderation in output growth from something well above trend to back to trend growth over the period ahead. And that's normal after you have a rapid pickup. This difference in performance in large parts of the emerging world compared with the core of what we might call the established world leaves the global economy at a critical juncture. In Asia, capacity utilisation has more or less recovered, and growth will moderate. Many of the old industrial countries, in contrast, still have large volumes of idle capacity and are searching with increasing urgency for ways of increasing their growth. But they're having trouble increasing their own demand. So we face, as the IMF has said recently, some degree of slowdown. It's not a disastrous slowdown, but nonetheless some slowdown over the next year or two in global growth at a time when substantial spare capacity remains in the global economy. The global imbalances, so-called, still exist, and they have a new dimension. There's an imbalance in the location of spare capacity around the world. So what could be done to foster a better outcome for everyone? Well, there's been an increasing focus recently, as you know, on exchange rates with talks of currency wars and so on. My view is that more flexibility of exchange rates in the key emerging countries in Asia, including China, but not only China, would be part of a more balanced outcome. But exchange rate flexibility alone is not enough. Changes to exchange rates don't create global growth, they just redistribute it. Unless the exchange rate changes were accompanied by more expansion in demand globally, we wouldn't have solved the problem of excess capacity, we would only have relocated it. The additional step needed is stronger demand domestically compared with what otherwise would have occurred in the countries whose currencies would be appreciating in that scenario. Of course, there ought to be some room for that, given that the higher exchange rate would, other things equal, help to dampen inflation in those countries. So in principle, that could be, to some extent, a win-win outcome. The appreciating countries would be able to enjoy faster growth in living standards, that is in spending, without inflation, while the weaker countries whose currencies were going down would get a boost to their recoveries, which are struggling at this point. But there are some complications here. A number of Asian countries have been experiencing worrying increases in property prices. Low interest rates and easy financial conditions, which most of them have had, have contributed to that. Arguably, domestic financial conditions should be tighter, not easier, in those places. So it's not clear that monetary policy would be the best option in those countries. And here I'm not talking about Australia, of course. I'm talking about countries in the Asian region. It's not clear that monetary policy would be the best option to boost demand there. Having said that, allowing exchange rates to appreciate more quickly would probably help to handle the asset price dynamics. Well, what about fiscal policy in these countries? Many, though not all, Asian countries probably would have some scope for fiscal policy expansion given the very long record of fiscal prudence that they've had. But these countries are very unlikely to do things that would seriously impair their fiscal positions in the long run. So my suspicion would be that if fiscal action came, it would only be modest. Some people argue that structural changes are needed in a number of countries, particularly in China, to lower saving rates. These changes could involve a shift in the distribution of national income away from state enterprises to households who have a higher likelihood of spending the income. They could involve a more developed social safety net and so on. And in all likelihood, these sorts of changes will occur over time. But structural change is really a rapid process. So I think we should be realistic about how much difference exchange rate flexibility itself would make to the unbalanced nature of growth in the global economy, at least over the horizon of just a few years. It is definitely part of the answer, and it is surely in the interest of the countries with closely managed rates to accept more flexibility. But it's no panacea. A full resolution of the imbalances will take time. It will involve more far-reaching changes to very deep-seated attitudes to saving, which remain quite different across regions of the world. As incomes in Asia continue to rise, saving rates probably will fall, but only gradually. Meanwhile, aggregate saving rates in America and in much of Europe will have to rise over time, given how far financial obligations, have moved ahead of likely future income, particularly on the public side. So the question is whether those two trends, lower saving in Asia, higher in the developed world or parts of it, will occur at the same speed or not, and a lot's going to hinge on that. good policies certainly can help the world get to a better solution than might otherwise occur, but even with good policies, it's likely to be a slow grind out of the current difficulties for a number of countries. We probably have to accept as well that global growth was unsustainably fast in the few years just prior to the crisis, that too much capacity of certain types was built up in the wrong places, that spending in some countries ran too far ahead of permanent income, and that therefore a period of adjustment and structural change can't be avoided even under ideal policy settings. If that's so, then in all countries, an emphasis on accepting the need for adjustment generally, not just in exchange rates but in economic policies and structures across the board, is important, is key, in fact. Well, let me conclude. Economies are not static machines. They're complex and dynamic combinations of actors, all of whom are seeking continually to adapt to changing conditions. And that's one reason why economic outcomes are very hard to predict and why I'm very circumspect about predicting Australia in 2020. Looking to the long run, we can probably make a few general observations, but not much more. One of those is that real income per head has generally been on an upward trend in industrial countries for the past 250 years, and most likely that will continue, albeit that some major countries are going to take a few years to recover the income levels they had 3 years ago. As a broad observation stemming from that, and definitely not, I repeat, not as a precise forecast, we might expect that a decade from now, Australia's per capita real GDP will probably be about 15% higher than it is today, give or take a few percentage points. And the economic policy debates, by the way, will all be about what can gain or lose those few percentage points. In 2020, there'll probably be an extra couple of million people working in Australia compared with the 11.3 million we have today. But exactly how all those people working will earn their living and go about their work is considerably less predictable. A good proportion of the 13-plus million jobs we're likely to see then will be in firms that don't exist yet. A good proportion of them will probably be in occupations or industries that barely exist as yet. And no one can give you a blueprint for which areas will succeed and which won't, any more than the pundits a decade ago, at the height of a new economy fad, could have foreseen the shape of Australia's economy today. Succeeding in the future won't ultimately be a result of forecasting. It will be a result of adaptation to the way the world is changing and giving constant attention to the fundamentals of improving productivity, which ultimately, of course, is the source of all growth in living standards. And that adaptability is as important as ever in the uncertain times that we face. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming, Governor, and addressing our conference. It's a great privilege to have you with us. Productivity is an issue you mentioned right at the end of your speech. You might have noted Australia's productivity has been pretty flat for some time now, and we have a combination of issues around skills and technology and infrastructure. There's action around them. But, I mean, what's your feeling about how we're going to get this thing moving again? What do you think are going to be the important levers? It's clearly a vital one in your inflation management task, certainly a vital one to us in industry who want to manage wage issues, et cetera, and to Jed here. So I'd be very interested in your view about that issue.
Well, I don't have a golden or silver bullet I could suggest gets fired, unfortunately, because productivity, there's no lever called productivity that you pull on and something happens. I think it is true that while the data was ambiguous for a few years, it's pretty clear now that there has been a material slowdown in the pace of growth of productivity compared with what we saw in the 90s. Some of that is probably attributable to the fact that we're engaged in a big build-up of capacity in certain sectors, particularly resources, and there will likely be large gains in productivity in the future from those areas. But that doesn't negate in any way, I don't think, the observation that across the board productivity looks a little lower. The thing is that I think, you know, it isn't governments and it's not ultimately policies that create productivity, it's firms, it's enterprises. And it's by doing the thousand and one things every day to do things a little better. And I guess the focus for policy is to make sure that, you know, public policies are not unduly turning out to be an impediment to that process. And I guess that's where, you know, people are going to have different opinions about whether that is or isn't happening. But the focus on competition policy, on infrastructure, the stuff that COAG does, industrial relations, all those things matter, as I don't need to tell you, I know, for productivity performance over time. Not directly mechanically today, but they all matter greatly over the long run. So we have to keep a focus, I think, there on all those things. And that's, you know, that's a hard grind. And I'm preaching to the converted there, I know.
How about this one? Given the terms of trade are at a 60-year high, what impact will that have on your goal of keeping inflation between 2 and 3% over the cycle?
Well, a 60-year high in the terms of trade, you think that through. The trade sector is a fifth of the economy. One-fifth of 60 is 12% of GDP of extra income in the economy. That's, you know, we're talking 12% of GDP is roughly $150 billion, pretty serious money. And that's expansionary. So as a general proposition, it's an expansionary shock, which is why we've been talking the way we have about the need to have a monetary policy that recognises that. It's also, though, it's a very large change in relative prices that will occasion structural adjustment in the economy. Minerals, energy, the bits of construction that help them, all the other parts of the economy that feed into the resource sector, they're going to grow. Other parts of the economy, as a share, will get smaller. Not, they won't necessarily get smaller absolutely, but relatively, they don't grow as fast. And you know, that's hard for those people to adapt to. So there's a structural adjustment dimension here, not just the macroeconomic inflation story as well. And that's really what people are talking about when they have the discussion about two-speed economies and so on. So I think that that's a test for us, but it's also a test for the capacity of the economy, industries, government to cope with structural adjustment as well. That's quite a, you know, it's quite a big issue that we face. And assuming that the terms of trade, we're not assuming they stay this high. Actually, we're assuming they come down a bit but remain still pretty high for some time. And the economy will adjust to that, and that is usually fraught with, you know, a certain degree of tension and stress in some sectors. It's unavoidable, and we should be devoting our energies to helping the adjustment occur smoothly, but nonetheless adjustment has to occur.
We, as we talked again about this morning, we are increasingly in a dynamic digital world that is just constantly pulling the rug of certainty from under our feet. I just wonder, that band of 2 to 3% was legislated, was set at a particular time in our history. Now, if everything else is changing with such fluidity around us and so dynamically, are you comfortable that we simply continue without any introspection to just accept that that should always be the norm?
Well, I have a lot of introspection about many of these things, but I still think this is the right goal. We didn't do any better coping with previous terms of trade shocks by letting inflation go to 25% like we did in the 1950s. That was followed by a deep recession. In the 1970s, we went to 20%. Followed by 10 years of not very good economic performance. So tolerating inflation didn't help us, it hurt us.
But we're talking about potentially degrees of maybe 0.5%.
But we're talking about a target which has an adequate degree of flexibility to handle short-run shocks and which will still anchor the price level and expectations over time, and that's what's important. If you let that go, then you go back to a world of much more uncertainty in the economy and, by the way, much higher nominal interest rates than we presently have. So it's not a world you want to go to.
No, but I'm not talking about just letting it go and going straight back to the old ways. I'm talking about whether there is sense in a periodic review of the target with a view even to tweaking. I mean, it seems to be such a fixed set of numbers.
I don't think it's as rigid as you're making out. It's, you know, we're half the time below two or above three as shocks come along.
Right.
The main idea is to anchor the medium term, and that remains critical. In a world where we could have inflationary pressure, but other countries have deflationary pressure, equally from that point of view, you want to anchor this.
Oh, yes. Whereabouts, sorry? Just here.
Thank you for your outstanding presentation. Following up on Heather, the productivity issue, could you talk a little bit about how you envision the linkage between productivity growth and how China and India will maintain their job creation machines? Because that certainly is going to be a huge down-the-road challenge for them.
You mean productivity growth in those countries?
Yes, because they have virtually none at this point.
Well, actually, they have very fast growth in income per head, which is usually what happens when you take a country with, not much capital stock, not much know-how. You have very high rate of investment and saving. They take on a massive accumulation of physical capital, and they accumulate know-how quickly. So their productivity growth actually, particularly in China, is pretty fast, which is why their income per head is growing as quickly as it is, and why hundreds of millions of people in these countries have been lifted out of poverty in the past 15 years or so. The trick is that, so this is a process of catch-up, right, to where the advanced countries have always been. The trick will be one day, it's not soon, but one day out there when the catch-up has occurred, at that point it's harder for that growth in living standards to keep going as quickly as it was. That's a good problem to have in the sense that, you know, you've now got a high level of living standard. I think that's some time away for them. And I think we're likely to see, most likely, pretty rapid growth in living standards and in productivity in those kinds of countries for quite a long time yet.
Glenn, just before you go, a quick question about the situation right now for you as governor. In your time as governor, is this the most complex for you and the board in weighing up interest rate movements, even including the global financial crisis? What was clear in that time was that interest rates were going one way. It was, I guess, a matter of timing. But you're juggling so many aspects now, the two-speed global economy, the two-speed domestic economy, the dollar where it hasn't been for an incredibly long time, various other aspects playing into this.
Yeah, don't give us any more complications. That's enough. Well, in some respects, what we face right now is not that dissimilar to 2006-07, where we had the build-up in strength, where we had various wobbles in some of the major countries, and no one knew which way these two forces would ultimately net out. I think all one can do in that is, and we've said this, is to respond to what you think the central scenario is and think about what other things could happen and be ready to respond to those quickly if they occur. The benefit that we had in 2008 was that we had capacity to respond quickly, as did the federal government on fiscal, because of the years and years of investment and sound policy structures leading up. So we have to remake those investments in the years ahead in order that next time there's some big event, we've got the same scope and flexibility to respond that we had then.
Now, I'm going to take an executive decision, Heather, and keep this going for a couple of minutes. I've got another couple of good questions here. We're not going to eat into the time of our next speaker, which means we're going to eat into your eating time, slightly. Should the ACCC investigate price collusion by the Big Four? The ACCC already has a role doing so in the something market, with little evidence of it occurring. Why would banking be any different?
Well, I think that's for the ACCC to answer, really, not me. And I'm sure Mr. Samuel has all that under control.
You heard, I'm not sure at what point you arrived, you heard at least a part of what Joe Hockey had to say today. He clearly believes that the power of the banks is not healthy, that the four major banks, as he says, have largely become the Australian financial system. Amongst other things, he's urging more regular reporting by the RBA of bank net interest margins and profits. And he's talking about monopolistic practices there. Any observations?
Well, we already report margins, profits, capital and so on regularly now in our standard publications, and that's been the case for a while, so we'll continue to do that. I don't really have anything to offer about the broader suggestions he made. That's for other people to respond to, I think, not me, and certainly not on the run.
Okay. Well, we might hear about that in the near future then. But quickly, is the NBN the potential productivity booster it's touted as, therefore would it help to manage our inflation challenge?
Well, again, I don't think I'm going to bite on the NBN. In principle, interconnectedness is a potential aid to productivity, but it depends how you use it and depends how much you spent to put it in, I guess. And they're the issues, right? Yeah.
What do you think, Glenn Stevens?
Thanks very much for that, Glenn.
Okay, Terry.
Good on you. All the best. You too.